Good morning.
So I've been watching women knitting, and here's my thoughts. Male teachers are intimidated by women knitting for the following reasons. If they're well-educated and liberal, they know that knitting has been, and weaving have been recovered, not as mere insignificant crafts, but as historic women's art forms. So there's no way we're going to be caught criticizing them. Second, as far as we can tell, women who are knitting are fully attentive to everything going on in class, which suggests a multitasking capability unknown to men. So for instance, I was trying to think of an analog. What could the men sitting here be doing that would resemble knitting? I mean, drinking beer and watching football, but then you really would have left the classroom to do that.
There's a great thing on YouTube about, there's a comedian, and he talks about how men having the nothing box, and women being all networked in their brain, feelings and stuff, and men have their brains divided into little boxes, and there's the beer box, and there's the dinner box, and where men really like to be is in the nothing box.
Okay.
When I worked at Boeing, we had these meetings that went on forever. And I was always tempted to take up knitting so I'd have something to
Yeah. I think we do suspect that knitting does serve that multi-purpose. So if the lecture turns out to be, or the discussion turns out to be, way more boring than you had hoped, you can simply fully attend to your knitting. On the other hand, if it's a pleasant surprise, actually slightly stimulating, then you can just keep knitting, but also pay attention. When professors look out at a sea of laptops, we always know that a fairly small percentage of them are taking notes on our lectures. Most of them are tuned to email, YouTube,
solitaire,
such things. So this is the third in a series called Imagining Prophets. First was Moses, then yesterday Elijah, today Amos, tomorrow John the Baptist, and Friday Jesus. It occurred to me this morning that I haven't previously said why I chose that title. You wouldn't have a class called Imagining Politicians. We are awash with politicians, and they require no imagination. You wouldn't need a class called Imagining Wall Street Bankers, or Investment Bankers, or Capitalists, or maybe even Venture Capitalists. Everybody knows about them. So the reason I proposed Imagining Prophets is that it could be we really don't have a handle on them, and therefore, I mean, if we know our way around the Bible a bit, we know that they are a historic category or role in the Jewish and Christian traditions. But there's not a lot of them around, so they're not obvious. And the hook for this class, which follows a so-called hermeneutical or interpretive strategy of immersing oneself, sort of seeing what's going on in my day before heading back to biblical times. We all still have fresh in our memory when we began hearing of candidate Obama's Chicago pastor, his UCC pastor, Jeremiah Wright. And sophisticated people writing for the major dailies, as well as the ravers on cable television, and maybe most American people, didn't have a category into which Jeremiah Wright fit, other than angry black man. And most of us probably thought that angry black men had mostly died off, or stopped being angry, because the country had grown so inclusive. And then there was this person who, via selective YouTube pieces, seemed to be flailing his arms and railing against America. And in a country that still purports to be something like 72% Christian, secularists and Christians, and maybe Jews as well, most of whom in America are, the majority of whom in America are secular and ethnic rather than religious. Nobody immediately said, oh, well, of course, it's the Elijah kind, it's the Elijah guy, it's the Amos guy, it's the Moses guy. I watch that, I read the New York Times every day of my life, as well as local regional papers, and no one said that. No one said, well, that's clearly the category into which this person fits. And all those people in Old Testament times were just slightly bizarre and occasionally crazy. So we get it. We see that. In fact, most of us even weren't familiar enough with the black church to see that this was a role that, of necessity, had needed to evolve in the black church, because of its existential situation in a formerly slave culture. So we just didn't get it. So with that in mind, we obviously haven't forgotten the primaries and the electoral season yet. And Obama himself maybe made the political decision that he couldn't assume that the electorate had that category in the back of his mind. So he had to dump his pastor. And maybe Jeremiah Wright contributed a fair amount of that to himself as well. Because prophets, they think differently. And as I said on Monday in Abraham Heschel's famous line, when they're in the choir, they always sing an octave too high. So today is Amos, and we'll do as we have done. We'll look at three sections, brief sections of Amos, just to sort of get Amos in the room, and then we'll move to the issues on the board. So if you'd open your Bibles to Amos. First, would someone read Amos 2, 6, and 7? But let me first set this up for you. Imagine it's the 4th of July. A million people have gathered in Washington, and tens of millions are watching on television. And a very famous preacher has been called to preach a 4th of July sermon. And this is actually Amos 1 and 2. And in this sermon, this famous preacher begins a global tour of what recently we've called the Axis of Evil. Okay? He, of course, would probably start with maybe Iran, then hit North Korea, depending on how things are going in Iraq and Afghanistan, maybe include them. Then, if his sympathies lie with capitalism, a few snide remarks about Scandinavian socialism, something about how the Germans seem to have lost confidence in their own culture because they're no longer reproducing themselves, and certainly then moving to Mexico for the drug problem, a couple snotty remarks about Canada that doesn't have the sense to defend itself, and so the North American Strategic Defense Early Warning System has to be run by the Americans because Canada is too peace-nicky to even worry about defending its own borders. And everybody's really raving, and there's just a terrific celebration of the United States because it's the only country that is not falling under the preacher's condemnation. We've really written off the entire world, and we are the only beacon of hope left, so let's raise the flag and sound the trumpets. Okay, that's what's going on. And that's exactly the way Amos 1 and 2 is structured. It begins on the periphery of ancient Israel, the so-called Northern Kingdom. And people are cheering wildly, if you can imagine this. This is some kind of, not quite the 4th of July, but some kind of occasion like that, a nationalistic celebration. But then people perhaps don't quite notice it immediately, but Amos begins closing in. You know, the concentric circles keep coming closer to home. So I've just picked two verses from finally the boom is lowered and the target is not foreigners, but Northern Israel itself. So Amos 2, 6 and 7, somebody please.
Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not revoke the punishment, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of the way. Father and son go into the same girl, so that my holy name is profaned.
Okay. So what we would call, he turns to social justice issues at home, selling the needy for a pair of shoes and so forth. So you sort of see, and of course at this point, Amos turns from a celebrated preacher into an unwelcome prophet. You know, I mean, this was a great occasion. Why did he have to ruin it? If you invite somebody for dinner, you don't expect that they're going to critique you. You know, even if they're a bit of an edgy person, you assume that you can count on their manners to carry them through the dinner party. You know, the turd in the punch bowl problem. You assume that they'll play by the rules of the party and not ruin everything for everybody. Okay, now Amos 3, verse 2. Let's hear that one.
You only have I known of all of the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquity.
Okay. So, whoa, who knew that's the way it was going to go? So imagine God saying, you know, from 1776 on, you've been my favorite country. And as your Puritan forebears said, you were on an errand, title of a very famous book on Puritanism, you were on an errand into the wilderness. You, after Europe screwed everything up through all those years of Christendom, suddenly a city on a hill, a bright light beaming, was once again shown from Massachusetts and Virginia on westward. And it's just so terrific that Christianity infusing itself through a national consciousness is once again happening. So that's the way we think it's going to go. You never dreamed that then the second line was going to be, and therefore I'm going to be hardest on you. You're the ones I'm picking out for punishment. And then still in chapter 3, verse 8.
The lion has roared. Who will not fear? The Lord God has spoken, but who can prophesy?
Okay, so this is a classic version of Hebrew poetry in which you have two strophes or two sentences which say the same kind of thing, but in different words. So can a lion not roar? You know, it's like, is the Pope Catholic? Do bears break wind in the woods? It's that kind of a thing. So does a lion roar? Yeah. Do prophets prophesy? Yeah. So there is, this actually would have served Amos well, because he wants to sort of be saying, a slight sympathy appeal, you know, I know you don't like my words. I know I'm unpopular. I know I ruin your national celebratory events. But that's what prophets do. Prophets have a call to speak the word of the Lord, no matter how hard they try to stifle it back. It's just what prophets do. Then, one of the great, most famous prophetic confrontations in the Old Testament, Amos 7, 10 to 13. Come on.
Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to King Jeroboam of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the very center of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words. For thus Amos has said, Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel must go into exile away from his land. And Amaziah said to Amos, O seer, go, flee away to the land of Judah, earn your bread there, and prophesy there, but never again prophesy at Bethel, for it is the king's sanctuary, and it is a temple of the kingdom.
Okay. So, someone in the audience who is an old classmate of mine and has spent his ministerial career as a hospital chaplain has already called my attention to how annoying it was of me to put the word chaplain on the board in the bad guy category. Chaplain is not a compliment in this polarity here. And I say this as someone whose brother was a Missouri Synod Army chaplain, one of the rare chaplains who was killed in duty in Vietnam. And my brother-in-law, his whole career has been an Air Force chaplain, so I sort of know about chaplains. And I don't want to get into the subject of military chaplains this morning. But I'm using chaplain as a person paid by and for the purpose of supporting some institutional mission or agenda. So presumably hospital chaplains don't spend their time, most of it, shaking their fist at the hospital. And military chaplains don't spend most of their careers, especially military chaplains, don't spend most of their careers railing against the Pentagon. Else they will never be promoted. But I'm using chaplain in a sort of generic sense, not about hospitals, not about the military, but the chaplain, or another term would be the priest role. So in biblical studies and in anthropology and religious studies, we sometimes have these two polarities, the prophet role and the priest role. Okay, the prophet is a countercultural figure who speaks against the system, and the priest, an honored role, one of Jesus' titles often in Christianity is priest, prophet, priest, and king. The priestly role is to say it snotty, is to serve the status quo, but you don't have to be that quite snotty because status quo is a snotty word. You could just say the priestly role is to attend to the needs of existing realities and institutions. Okay, the priest serves more or less the way things are, and the people who find themselves rooted in the way things are. Okay, so that's Amos. Insulting Israel on the 4th of July, saying he has no choice but to be rude and obnoxious because he's speaking the word of the Lord, and that's what prophets do. And then Amos, in a major confrontation with the chaplain, the priest who serves the northern kingdom. Remember, after David and Solomon's period in 1000 BC, Israel splits into the northern kingdom, which goes into exile earlier than the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom rooted in Jerusalem, the northern kingdom rooted in Samaria, and so forth. Amos is a northern kingdom prophet. So the northern kingdom is not centered in Jerusalem. It's Washington, D.C. is not Jerusalem, but in a northern kingdom city. And there are royal chaplains. So I'm borrowing, I think this person is Bennett Holden now and then. Walter Brueggemann is not a Lutheran, although he has about 15 books published by Fortress Press. A very famous Old Testament scholar. His book, The Prophetic Imagination, is in the library. And he and others in Old Testament scholarship use the word royal theology. The royal theology is that theodicy, that religious justification of the aspirations of the state. Okay, the royal theology. the person who, in the name of God, justifies the aims and directions of the state. Okay? So the person who does royal theology is sometimes called the royal chaplain. Okay, so this term comes out of Hebrew Bible studies, not used in New Testament times. So this ministry of Amos that you now have before you raises a question. Does the church, can the church legitimately have, sponsor, train, ministers who serve the national interest and the American agenda? And can it raise and train and educate prophets who almost instinctively critique, denounce what's going on? And must the church be pleased to have both kinds of people? Does it prefer one over the other? And of course, going back to my first comment about reading the Bible from one's own context, it could be that in some other country, this question would parse differently. So we are a country which has celebrated the separation of church and state, mostly, as a way beyond the dead end that European Christendom had come to, and the wars of religion and all that following the Protestant Reformation. So when an American asks such questions, one possible answer is, well, don't even have this role. Not because we're so prophetic, but because we are not called to for there to be a religious role that upholds, praises, coaches, advises the state. But so there's the question. What do you think?
Well, isn't it a little bit illuminating that the closest to the prophetic encounter that I think of off the top of my head is Stephen Colbert at Bush's Roast, where he may not have been in the voice of the church, but he certainly held up a mirror,
mm-hmm.
which was mm-hmm. remarkably revealing and very discomforting, mm-hmm. apparently.
Yeah, especially at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Wouldn't that be interesting that if you yourself were felt called to be a prophet, but just couldn't take all the rejection, that you would turn yourself into a comedian? In other words, you would still, I mean, I do that with my classes sometimes. I ridicule them in a way that makes them laugh. Ridicule is not the word, but I prod them in a way that makes them laugh so they don't hate me so much and accept me. But, so we could have, I don't think that we do, but we could have Christian comedians who somehow satirize the country into self-reflection and self-criticism. What else?
I would postulate that we have to have the royal chaplains because there's some things that churches do, pastoral care and all that, mm-hmm. the prophets don't do, and as a result, the ideal model for a prophet would be either to have a MacArthur grant or be independently wealthy or something and not have to rely on not have to be a team player.
Yeah, okay.
In a church.
So prophets don't make hospital calls. Prophets denounce hospitals, but they don't make hospital calls.
They don't have virus.
Yeah, so that's a very nice statement. Somebody has to care. Care for the flock, care for the nation. Because the nation is simply the ethnic, well, maybe not ethnic, the some consciousness of all the people written to a larger level, so presumably it needs tending. So that seems like, I talked on Monday or Tuesday that a cathedral church in a city, especially a Catholic or Anglican cathedral church, and in Europe could be a Lutheran one as well, in part wants to see itself as a carer for the whole urban area. Okay? The whole, we want to be pastor to the whole urban area.
It's interesting, you know, as at Sunitha's, one of her lectures, and she was talking about India in a collectivistic society versus the United States as an individualistic society. And it seems to me that just bringing that sort of thought, that many churches as institutions are collectivistic. I mean, we're sort of like a big ocean liner. We've got this big system rolling and moving in one direction. It's the vector's strong. Mm-hmm. And it needs to do that. And so what is a church? You know, is it an institution? And is it just on track? And then maybe the prophets are an important thing. Hey, there's a waterfall down below there, you know, and I'm going to push the boat out of the way so it doesn't go down the waterfall, but nobody's listening, and the boat keeps going. So it seems like it's an ecological necessity.
Yeah.
Even though not a very welcome one.
Yeah, some of the, I agree with that, that there are different roles, kind of the low-level roles of individual care for, and then the prophets. And the part of what's disturbing about discussion of prophets is that not all countercultural criticism is the same or is valid. And that, you know, I've realized through this discussion that your definition of prophets does include Jeremiah Wright. Even though you're making no judgment as to whether his criticism is, you know, is
legitimate,
valid, and even then, whatever his criticism is contextual based on where society is. That today's prophets might not be as successful, you know, 100 years ago. And so, I guess, in that light, where do the, you know, if you've got 100 prophets that are all trying to steer in that analogy, the boat different directions. You know, you're still the collective people have to kind of rate and judge the criticism and have it kind of permeate the society before any given kind of future vision will emerge. Mm-hmm. And how do you sort out the prophets in that way? I
mean,
is that false the prophets.
Yeah, Amos false made the big book, but there are probably dozens of others that didn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking about this model where the priest does the care for the congregation, and therefore there is not so much space for the prophet because maybe funding. But what if the priest enables the congregation to take care of each other?
Uh-huh.
And more community. We are all in the same.
We should remind ourselves, in the social sciences, we use the term ideal type, in which we sort of look at all the data, and then we say, wow, to cover all this data, I see sort of maybe three basic types. And each one is a kind of magnetic power, and all the loose filings, some of them are all going to come here and for conceptual clarity, here and here and here. We don't really mean that out of 1,000 preachers, they all fit into just three categories. We mean that a way of making sense of very broad, disparate data is to say these are three clusters. These are three syndromes that help account for what we're looking at and help understand. So probably even the dean of an urban cathedral or a wonderful Lutheran pastor who is very priestly, doesn't think caring for the people with a gentle hand is the only thing she ever does. Okay? That might be a leading role, a predominant role, or even 50%. In fact, wouldn't it be interesting to do a time and motion study? Some of you are clergy. To do a time and motion study. I spend 10% of the week being prophetic, 60% of the week being pastoral or priestly or chaplainy, and I don't know what other percentage, dodging bullets and things.
Fundraising.
Yeah, of course, fundraising. What else? Did I see? Yeah, please.
The royal chaplains, for instance, during the Holocaust, they didn't speak out. And I think during the build-up to the Iraq War, some of the clergy actually went along and said, we have this horrible person, and we've got to spread democracy. And
yeah.
It seems to me there are certain turning points where you do need a prophet to speak against the grain.
Yeah. I must say, I keep being conscious just because I've met so many of you. Unlike in Lutheranism, as I recall, having been alive at that point, the Episcopal Church in the United States took a tremendous hit during Vietnam by, I suppose you could say, being prophetic. And many people voted with their feet and their money, and there was massive attrition. And that's the cost, that's the price that prophetic ministry sometimes, maybe not always, sometimes has to pay. In the Civil War, we couldn't manage being the same church body while being prophetic, and so the Presbyterians, the Methodists, all split in two. Baptists, Southern Baptists, Northern Baptists. Southern Presbyterians, Northern Presbyterians. Southern Methodists, Northern Methodists. Not so much hierarchical churches like Lutherans, Catholics, and Episcopalians. Those managed somehow, because their locus of control, as we might say, ideally was larger than a regional area. And so those church bodies did not split. But it doesn't mean there weren't severe fractures in them. So,
it seems too, like, doesn't Jesus encourage us as individuals to be prophets in a way? And I think we're not necessarily headline prophets, we're not Amos,
mm-hmm.
but we may get into a discussion on homosexuality,
yeah.
and we may want to express our views,
yeah.
and we may, you know, mm-hmm. it may not be very popular.
Is that, I'm kind of struggling with this notion of prophetic. Are we just talking about speaking our opinions loudly, you know, strongly, even when they're running against the grain? Or is there some sense that God has given us these opinions or opened our eyes to these opinions? Because all I keep thinking of with the, you know, prophetic voices, I think it was Pat Robertson after Katrina
right.
or 9/11,
right.
this is God's punishment
right.
for all this sexual
right.
immorality. I'm sure he was absolutely convinced that, you know, God had told him this
mm.
and it was against the common
yeah.
grain of culture and he was going to speak out. And so how do we know that we aren't as, you know, misled as he is?
Right. So
we've got strong feelings about
yeah.
him.
And there is no reliable. So, I mean, that's a very crucial issue, both in as a theological issue and as a sociological issue. Surely all the Old Testament prophets, indeed their own verses, from Moses, Lord, I'm not even eloquent. Give it to Aaron or somebody else. I don't want to do this. And then God makes him do it and says, here's the words. Isaiah says, in the middle of worship, Isaiah 6, you know, there's sort of awe-inspiring, and he has some kind of a vision, and the angel takes a piece of charcoal from the incense and comes and puts it on Isaiah's lips to cleanse them so they will only speak, so his lips will only speak the name of the Lord. The German poet Rilke has a wonderful, powerful line in which he alludes to somebody whose ear has been slightly stopped or altered, so it will only hear the God's voice. And Amos says, hey, lions roar, prophets speak the name of Yahweh. That's the way it is. So they surely all thought they were speaking the name of the Lord, the word of the Lord. And presumably, if you can grant people the benefit of the doubt, modern prophetic figures in the Jewish and Christian traditions, let's say, we won't look at other traditions, believe that they are answering God's call and speaking in the name of the Lord. But already in ancient Israel, the question rose, well, how do you know who's the false prophet and who's the true prophet? And then it's not going to comfort us at all to hear the answer. If they make you feel good, they're probably the false prophet. You know? If they say evil lies in other countries and good lies at home, they're almost certainly a false prophet. And Jesus takes up the same thing. Lord, Lord, and all that. You know, don't believe the people who are on feel-good self-esteem missions. They're almost never prophets, true prophets. But you can't reliably know. So, I mean, a typical answer I suppose they teach us in seminary is, you know, when amidst the crucible that a local parish is, when you're looking for true direction and the true voice of God, you will have to develop spiritual discernment through the intensive life of the community. We're all going to have to get together and chew on this and see if we can get some clarity from God. But maybe the only clarity will be we'll split into two. I must say, on the gay issue, at this very moment, at least, too early to tell, the ELCA may be having somewhat more success than the Episcopal tradition in the United States, but the Episcopal tradition is down the road several years, and we just got there last week. So who knows whether, how, but I don't want to move in that direction, but who knows how that's going to turn out.
So does the biblical text actually give us any help in discerning a false prophet from a true prophet? Because the text sort of gives us, I think, you tell me if I'm wrong. One prophet at a time, right? One prophet at a time. And so they're always speaking God's truth, and they made it into the Bible and so forth. Nowadays, we have multiple prophets speaking, claiming to speak for the Bible and speaking for Christian truth, speaking truth to power. Some of them are on the left and some of them are on the right, and that was your point too. Do we have any guidance from the text about what to do when you've got competing messages?
If somebody want to respond to that, let me get to you. So a Lutheran answer might, well, one answer which doesn't help you at all is wait 100 years. You know, the prophets who made it, the canonical prophets, are the ones who were thought by succeeding generations of Jews and or Christians to be the true, the authentic word of the Lord. But, you know, that doesn't help you in the present. But we often say that, you know, in a college history class, you might say, you know, when Lincoln was alive, was he such, you know, the greatest American president? It took us quite a while to determine that to be the case. But a Lutheran answer, and maybe a Christian answer, might be, the Bible is such an abundant book. And diverse, and sometimes contradictory, that you got to go, as a fundamental hermeneutical principle you learn in seminaries, you know, you got to go with the bright passages, not the dark passages. And sometimes we call the bright passages the canon within the canon, okay, the crucial stuff. So go with the crucial stuff and say, can you imagine, if the crucial stuff is all you're going to let yourself think about, can this particular position that someone is taking, can it possibly be congruent with the crucial stuff? So on the gay issue, just quickly, if, and 100 years ago maybe people didn't think this, but if the reigning view of the ministry of Jesus is an inclusive, affirming ministry, then a gospel that focuses on rituals of exclusion cannot be made to live in sync with this canon within the canon, the non-negotiable, inclusive, affirming ministry of Jesus. But obviously there's a whole lot of Lutherans that are not gonna, that would not, and many Christians would not buy the analysis that I just gave.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, you take someone like Jim Wallace of Sojourners, who has, I think, literally gone through the Bible and like cut out all the references to poverty and injustice and so on,
and will often go around and hold up the text and say, okay, on the one hand, here are the passages dealing with homosexuality.
Yeah, all six of them.
Right, all six of them. And then here's a Bible that you have all the passages dealing with those issues cut out. And clearly, his point is that the main thread that he sees following through all of this is issues of injustice, love, compassion, mercy, and so on. So that would be one way to try to evaluate. And I think I'm just echoing what you're saying.
Yeah, so the joke goes when you're talking to a very self-congratulatory middle-class capitalist Christian, how come your Bible's so full of holes? You know, you say, well, I had to cut out the 1,000 verses that talk about God's obsession with the poor because I'm not into the poor. What else?
I've got a question about, social criticism can be done without kind of bringing in, using the Lord as a source of legitimacy.
Yeah.
And presumably, and a question is a historical question. So we've got this great document that describes the prophets that did use the Lord. Presumably there were ones who didn't, although maybe they weren't recorded. Like Stephen Colbert doesn't use the name of the Lord to justify his criticism.
Yeah.
And so what's the role of social criticism of the church in comparison to social criticism?
Yeah. Let me just give you a very quick, it's a big issue in rhetorical studies in ethics. So in a country that has separation of church and state, but a strong presence of religiosity, okay, what do you do? So one argument is you make all of your arguments only in the lingua franca of rational discourse, okay? So let's say you're anti-abortion and you're Catholic or evangelical or whatever. You agree ahead of time that you will argue against abortion using the language of philosophical or rational discourse, and you will only use that language because that's the language that every American speaks, ideally. Okay. Thomas Jefferson would have made this argument, and very many thoughtful political people. Governor Cuomo of New York, a devout Catholic, but who always was fighting off his bishop, who wanted him to sound more Catholic, even though he was a very well-educated Catholic, deeply immersed in the Catholic social teaching. Cuomo tended to argue that I have to speak as a rational being because everybody in New York speaks that language, and only some people in New York speak Catholic language. The opponents to that view, of which I am typically one, would argue that in the same way that we say to women, you know, we're glad to listen to you if you just sound like a man, you know, because male discourse is normative. So if you can learn to sound like a man, you will get a full credence. But women say, well, wait a minute, that denies something kind of essential about me. Women might have their own way of knowing. I mean, that's obviously a separate question. But if they do, then I'm going to speak that language. I'm not going to accommodate myself. And Henry Louis Gates said, I'm not going to talk to white cops in their discourse language. I'm going to speak out of the, we blacks have taken this for too long. And now there's a new crime, homeowning while black. So we're not going to take it anymore. So that view, which doesn't have to be religious, I mean, it could be religious because that's the topic here, but it could be gender-based or ethnicity-based or racial-based. These people are saying, no, you are seriously disenfranchising the single most important dimension of my identity. That you say, if there's a kind of neutral, normative, rational discourse that excludes religion or ethnicity or the black experience or the women's experience, I'm not buying the argument. I want to be able to mount the halls of Congress and speak the language of rational discourse and also out of my own self-consciousness or tradition. And that continues to be the argument I typically make in my own classes if I think I've got a lot of social activists in front of me is, do what's strategic. If you want the hunger, the hungry fed, and you'll get more hungry fed without appealing to the ministry of Jesus than don't appeal to the ministry of Jesus. On the other hand, if 72% of Americans say they're Christian, and that's a hook on their consciences, of course, there's all those people with the holes in the Bible that don't have those verses, then it could be strategically useful. But other people would say, Heinz is completely wrong. This is not a strategic question. If God is calling you to speak, you do not ask yourself whether it's strategic. You speak. Do lions roar? Do prophets speak the word of the Lord? You speak because you are called to speak. Even if you think, boy, we're going to go down on this ship because this is not going to go well at this party. No, you are called to do it. I wanted to go back to an issue. I talked about ideal types. So often there's quite a famous book in Christian ethics that divides, I'm just going to simplify this by making three categories, and I know we have at least one Catholic in here. So this argument goes that the Catholic preference in ethics is that you, if infiltrate is a good word, okay, that you institutionalize a Catholic consciousness. Think Italy, think Poland. You institutionalize a Catholic conscience into the social system, so it will always be in the presence of every individual, but also at the very centers of power, okay? Because you will have successfully made yourself part of the fabric, and it comes by osmosis. It's just out there in the air, okay? And I think that's a brilliant, the institutionalizing tradition. And of course, it worked in Europe, where you had Christendom, much dicier in the United States. But still, Boston thinks like Irish Catholics, to some extent, even today. Another tradition, sometimes associated with the Lutheran tradition, is you never want to, and you can never successfully implant yourself in the consciousness of a national consciousness, but you want to be in the dialogue, so you live in constant edgy paradox with the centers of power, okay? Preserving your own integrity, but always having, you know, a dog in the fight, always being involved, okay? So this is the paradoxical thing. And then the pure Anabaptist tradition, not modern-day Christian Rite, which has really deserted that historic position, but or the Quaker position, stand still in the light. That lovely Quaker phrase, stand still in the light. You are called to live outside the system. Or Amish, even, you could say, but even more mainstream things. You are called to live outside the system. Christians, William Stringfellow, a famous radical ethicist, and others, you know, Vietnam or the war or poverty or justice, feeding the punk, whatever. It has to be the pure integrity of your own example. My own view is that insufficiently challenges powerful economic and political systems. But they would argue, yeah, but we don't sell out. And we have the purity. We have not accommodated. We have not adjusted Jesus to make him work better at parties. Okay. We have not adjusted the Christian tradition so it fits inside the Beltway better. No, we're just going it pure, and people either buy it, as Hebrews says, wow, people come knocking on your door and say, we are inquiring about the hope that is within you, that wonderful New Testament line. That's what they're hoping for. We'll do it so pure, so authentically, so crystal clear, that people will sort of get it. For me, it's not engaged. And the most famous example today, a guy at Duke Divinity School, Stanley Hauerwas, would represent that tradition. Don't work the system. Don't enter the system. Preserve the integrity of the Christian tradition all by itself. Other people will or will not get the idea, but when you're at St. Peter's Gate, it won't be how influential you were, but how true to the tradition, to God's call, to imitating Jesus, you were. Okay, let's go to... So here, Amaziah, royal theologian, the royal chaplain, says this wonderful line. It's right up there with "Art thou who, he who troubleth Israel?" Or "Have you found me, O my enemy, Ahab," to Elijah. This is an equally delicious line. "The country, maybe you're a good guy, and we wish you well in Arkansas or Oklahoma, but here inside the Beltway, we are not able to bear your words." Isn't that it was a wonderful line? The nation, the king, is not able to bear your words. So we're not going to kill you. Maybe we're not even going to be all that resentful. We just don't want you hanging around national institutions. Billy Graham, you may know, we all get wiser as we're dying, has said in retrospect he probably was too chummy with Nixon. And it's common, Jim Wallace has made this point, and other evangelicals have confessed that it's very heady to be at the centers of power. When the president's not clear what to do next and you're on the line, wouldn't the Episcopalians and the ELCA people and the Catholic people be pleased if the Cardinal Archbishop of New York were the first guy on the fast dial for Obama or Bush or whoever? So and that's called access. And if you're always snotty and insufferable and unyielding and only speaking the word of the Lord, then they take you off the fast dial. And Billy Graham said, he thought that maybe he liked being the chaplain to Republican and Democratic presidents. It was quite heady. He was the nation's evangelist, and he was also the chief counselor, might have even led George W. back to Christ and off of his alcoholism. So, you know, that's a notch on your gun. But the price you pay for access is that you have to be reasonable and sort of deal with the way things are, not the way they should be if everything were perfect or if the kingdom of God had arrived. But so back to the question, what if our various church bodies represented in the room were told, of course, you have your constitutional guarantees, but your words are, we can't bear your words near the centers of power. We can't bear your words in legislatures and state houses and in Washington, D.C. So, you know, stick to the boonies and it'll be fine.
Well, I think a lot of that happens on a local basis, you know, within the church council. You know, it's just how things work. It's how, you know, people want to do things. And it's not simply, you know, the difficult issues of national issues, it's just, it's local issues. And how do you make things work on a local basis? Mm. It's comfortable.
I'm sure the Episcopals have the same thing, but the ELCA has, I'm not sure whether the Missouri, maybe you guys can tell me whether the Missouri Synod does, but the ELCA has an office of whatever it's called, the Office of National Affairs or something. And I think it's actually in D.C. rather than in Chicago. And you might think there shouldn't even be such a thing, but if you grant that there should be such a thing, how pesky do you want them to be? The Vatican has a nunciate to America who's quite willing to be pesky. Although somehow when the Pope met with Obama, he didn't keep harping on abortion, we think, didn't bring up Notre Dame. Had other fish to fry, so maybe even the Pope can say, is my most effective ministry to the President of the United States going to occur by harping at him, or are there alliances we can make on things that we agree on that are also maybe Christian-driven? And if we're to believe the rumors, maybe that was the Pope's choice.
But people like the Pope and their predecessors have historically always been part of the establishment, or the establishment, and in Europe, and we're not that different over here. So how would you expect them to abandon what they perceive and are trained to be their mission of holding the institution together and say, well, I think I'm going to
See, I think the idea that a church leader like that can give 10% of the time to being a pescador, I don't think it's possible.
So, I mean, your last question on the board is, I read it as, should there be lobbyists for the church
right.
in D.C.?
Let's call them lobbyists.
And the problem with that is that typically lobbyists aren't prophetic in terms of social criticism, but they represent the interests of the organization and make sure that the bodies of power don't act against the interests of the organization, not necessarily their directions for the society. And so I think you get into that
point. Yeah, and surely it would be a tremendous insult to a prophet to call him a lobbyist. but still, I mean, still, so imagine, you know, the Matthew 4 story, actually Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have it, you know, when Jesus goes into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil right after his baptism, and what is the temptation? You know, play ball with the status quo, you'll have way more success. You know, jump off the temple, boy, that's going to be a big one. Whoa, landed, didn't break his ankles. Or turn rocks into bread. And feed the hungry, that's going to go over big. So why not do stuff that's going to go over big, but that is congruent with the way people think and with social, economic, and political systems? You'll be way more effective. So I suppose you could imagine writing a play, even, in which a prophet is said, we're going to institutionalize your presence, you know, so you're not out in the wilderness all the time. We're going to send you to D.C., give you a salary, buy you a suit, and, you know, the hair shirts and the hair shirts and the grasshoppers, this isn't going to do it. So we're going to put you in D.C., and surely you would jump at the chance if you had the opportunity to influence the president and the Congress to doing things that were congruent with the Christian message. I mean, you could see that argument, right? I mean, wouldn't we buy that? I'd sign up. I already have a suit, and check that off. And somebody said, go to D.C., Obama will meet with you once a month, and you represent the most prophetic ministry in the ELCA to the president's staff. Maybe I'm just going to meet with Rahm Emanuel, but even that, you know, terrific. I mean, wouldn't you do that? Because it's strategic and it's influential. You don't just have to be out in Washington yelling, you know, in the Cascades or something. No, you're right there where it's all happening. You could see that would be a good move to make, even if it weren't the only move you were going to make.
Well, I mean, I guess I was just to take it for sort of on a bigger picture. It's the reason we have community, because then we can have prophets who are out there on the edge, and then others of us could be in more inside and can use what the prophets are saying to say, well, actually they're speaking truth, but how do we pragmatically make change happen in the system? Mm-hmm.
Great.
Are you familiar with Bread for the World?
Yes.
And aren't they, isn't that their primary mission?
Quite. And when you join Bread for the World, this is what I love about Bread for the World, you can have a couple of different categories. You can take a tax deduction if you say to Bread for the World, we want you to spend money on directly giving food to the poor. But then Bread for the World says, that's actually not mostly what we do. You know, that belongs into the charity category. No, we are legislative mobilization, and you don't get a deduction for it because you're a lobbyist. You're a Christian lobbyist for the hungry. And if you give us $100 a month, don't take a deduction on it because you're a Christian lobbying group. But then, as Bread for the World loves to say, I always tell this to my classes, all the charity of all the Christian churches in the United States on behalf of the hungry can be undone by a single legislative vote that goes bad. Like, let's cut food stamps this year. So one bad vote in Congress undoes all the charitable giving for the hungry. So that suggests, whoa, maybe there's something to being operative in the centers of power and putting a tie on and dressing up and speaking civilly, including in the language of rational discourse where that's appropriate and called for, and maybe that will be very effective. Tomorrow, John the Baptist you know ahead of time, that is not his role. He's not a lobbyist. He belongs in jail and dead, and he gets both.